Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's announcement by the Secretary of Defence outlining proposed cuts in the military budget that are in fact not cuts at all. William Hartung, the Director of the Arms and Security Program at the New America Foundation and author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, joins us to examine the numbers game and the astronomically expensive and useless weapons programs that are not being cut. Then we'll get an update on the Florida Republican primary as Gingrich and Romney do battle in a debate tonight to win the Latino vote they are trashing each other's record over. Joining us is Luis Martinez Fernandez, a historian of Latin America and the Caribbean at the University of Central Florida. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently teaches in Orlando, Florida. We will discuss the first Latino vote in Florida and the Cuban-American vote the candidates are fighting over. Then finally, a 23-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service who's retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats, Glenn Carl, joins us in the studio. We will discuss the recent arrest of an ex-CIA officer for espionage and the legacy of torture that haunts the CIA and caused Glenn Carl to resign from the CIA because he could not fulfill his oath to preserve and to protect the Constitution. He is the author of the new book, The Interrogator, and education. I'm now joined by William Hartung, who is the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets of War, that's prophets in the religious sense, Lockheed Martin, and The Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, good to be back.
And today, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta announced his first cuts in the 10-year, $487 billion reduction in Pentagon spending. But it's not really a reduction, is it?
No. I mean, basically, it's a reduction in the sense that the Pentagon wanted much, much more than they're getting now, and now they're having to give some of that back. But compared to current spending, it's going to go up about 7%, and even if you adjust for inflation over 5 years, down a percentage point or so. So given that we've been at record levels, it's really, you could barely call it an adjustment, much less a cut, I would say.
And specifically, they're talking about cutting the Army by 490,000 and the Marine Corps to 182,000. And they're going to have a new round of base closures and slow down the production of the F-35 fighter. Not cancel it or reduce it, but slow it down. What exactly are they saying?
Well, you know, they're mostly working at the margins. I mean, the cuts in the Marines and the Army will put us back where we were before 9/11, because there was a buildup in conjunction with the wars. And they're going to take 5 years to do it at a time when the Iraq War has been wound down. They're claiming they'll be out of Afghanistan. So it's, it's more of a kind of a managerial tweaking than a major policy change. Secretary Panetta was very clear. They want the F-35, it's the plane of the future, but they also acknowledge that it's having cost and performance problems, and they want to, one of the generals said they're having manufacturability problems, which is the first time I had heard that word. They're really slowing it down to see if they can get the cost under control, but there's, they're fully committed to the program.
And this is a program that by any reasonable measure is the greatest boondoggle, the most obscene waste of money, and the most useless weapon system probably that this gold-plated pork barrel Pentagon's ever come up with.
I wish I had put it that way myself. I think, first of all, the program as a whole would be the largest program in the history of the Pentagon, because they want to build 2,400 of these things, and also allies in the UK and Australia, and now Japan wants to buy them. There'll be another 9 or 10 countries in on the deal. And yet it's, cost twice what they promised initially so far. It can't meet many of its performance objectives. And it's not clear what the mission is. I mean, basically, they seem to be doubling down on this idea that the United States needs to be prepared to contain China. But it's hard to imagine the United States having aerial dogfights with Chinese fighter planes. So even that argument seems a little bit off. So I think you're right. It's mostly pork barrel. It's to keep Lockheed Martin happy and keep the defense industry kind of, you know, humming along at a high enough rate that, you know, if they want to build up even further down the road, they'll have all these parts in place.
But the plane really couldn't get in a dogfight. It's the stupidest thing where they've decided to build an airplane that is both a fighter, a ground attack, and a bomber, all in one. And it does none of them well. And they've concentrated on this stealth technology, which countermeasures have been developed in Russia and China to defeat. And stealth makes the thing useless for all of the above. But had they gone ahead and made updated the fighters that they have, the A-10 that they have, and basically bought cheaper versions of all three planes for all three missions, they'd save trillions.
Well, yes. You know, my colleague Winslow Wheeler at the Center for Defense Information and Pierre Spray, who was involved in some of the design decisions on the A-10, the F-16, have been very persuasive on this point. You know, it's sort of like this thing is supposed to do all things and does none of them well. In fact, is you know, as you suggest, does them worse than the prior generation. But I think there's this kind of gung-ho you know, fascination with the idea that this is going to be a fifth-generation fighter and it's going to do all these amazing things. And, you know, much of that is just wishful thinking.
But it's already killing its own pilots. They lost one up in Alaska recently, and they had to ground the entire fleet because of the oxygen supply to the pilot. Now, supplying oxygen to a pilot is not a sophisticated piece of technology.
No. I mean, it's really, it's very hard to explain other than in the kind of terms of needing to, you know, wanting to spend more money.
Well, again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who is the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation, and he's the author of the new book, Prophets of War. That's prophets in the religious sense. Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And Lockheed Martin, of course, announced its fourth quarter profits today, and this doesn't seem to be affecting their stock at all. The idea that maybe, what was the word that they used with the F-35? Remanufacturing or something?
Oh, well, that they're having manufacturability problems.
A manufacturability problem.
And they can't build one that works, you know.
In spite of that, you know, and of course, Newt Gingrich was the representative in the Congress for Martin Marietta, and he's running for president. And your book basically makes out that these people are the ones that really are making out. They're the ones that are shaping the defense budget. We cut the boys, but we don't cut the toys.
Well, exactly. And, you know, not only is Gingrich an old friend of Lockheed Martin, but, of course, Mitt Romney wants to spend, you know, about $1 trillion more over the next decade than what Obama would spend. So the industry would, you know, welcome him with open arms were he to, forbid thought when the election become the next president.
So what about this sequestration that we had heard so much about that would automatically cut another $500 billion over and above the $487 billion that the defense secretary was talking about today? Nobody thinks that's ever going to happen, right?
I don't think so. I mean, there's already John McCain has a version of a bill to roll it back. Buck McKeon and the House Republicans have their version of the bill. Panetta and the industry are screaming that it would, you know, hollow out our force and devastate our ability to defend ourselves for years to come. And I guess most importantly, it doesn't kick in until January 2013. So the most likely thing is there'll be a lot of political jousting this year, and then whoever wins the election will, you know, decide what to do in that period between November and January 2013. So it's mostly going to be a kind of a political football this year, although it will, you know, the nature of that debate may affect what can really be done later.
So a couple of the things that Panetta announced today, which I find very puzzling, is that he announced that the Pentagon will be funding the next generation bomber and the Navy will invest in a new design of its Virginia-class submarine. Now, my understanding, and that's the attack submarine, right? The Virginia.
Yes.
My understanding is that there's an extraordinary surplus of submarines with the end of the Cold War. All of those missile platforms, the Tridents and others, basically have been converted into intelligence platforms because there's no reason to have thousands of missiles pointed at the Soviet Union. So why in God's name do they need more submarines?
Well, the Navy talked about, late last year, it's sort of like you need to build them so you can keep building them. You know, they said, well, if we keep up a rate of a couple attack submarines a year, then when we want to build a new ballistic missile submarine, we'll have the facilities and skilled people available. So it's sort of like without asking who are these submarines going to attack and who are these missiles going to be targeted at, it's just kind of this bureaucracy that keeps going and going on its own steam.
So the only announcements of any cuts in terms of weapon systems are the retiring of 65 C-130s, which have all been replaced by the C-17, which in itself, its production line was extended far beyond anything the Pentagon wanted.
Well, yes. Boeing and its allies in Congress, year after year, managed to put in another 10 here, another 10 there. And the Pentagon, it took them quite a while to wind that down. It has happened with the F-22, where they had to fight tooth and nail to cut it off at a round where they had hoped to, instead of doubling it like Lockheed Martin and the Air Force had hoped to do.
And the Navy's going to keep its 11 carriers, the carriers, of course, with their task force around them, and the 10 air wings will also be kept. So, apart from the modest reductions in Army ground forces and Marine Corps ground forces and taking and retiring these obsolete C-130s, anything else that I'm struggling here to find out whether this is a real cut or just a cosmetic shuffling?
Well, I would lean towards cosmetic shuffling. The other thing that they've talked about is they want to play around with pay and benefits. And the way they're arguing is, well, we're not going to affect people currently in the force, but for the future, we'll institute co-pays, higher premiums for the health care, we'll slow the rate of pay increases. And, that's a hard sell, given the strength of the Navy League and the Air Force Association and the Retired Officers Association and so forth. And so they're kind of being careful about it, trying to make the case, well, it's not going to affect you, it's going to affect people coming later. It's sort of like when a manufacturer wants to bust the union, and so they try to just keep the new recruits from joining and kind of age out the union. This is, they're just trying to age out the people that get the current level of benefits and sort of bring in people at lower levels who join going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who is the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation and the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. So given that the president recently said the tide of war is receding and they appear to be getting out of Afghanistan, they've already gotten out of Iraq, notwithstanding there's a kind of the U.S. and Iran seem to be on a collision. A war there could possibly be precipitated by the Israelis. But if you take the president and his word that they don't want to do any more of these boots-on-the-ground disasters in the Middle East and they're looking more towards the Pacific, first of all, in terms of the wars that the U.S. has been involved in and even the operation in Somalia yesterday, the impression that you get is that we don't need these huge military forces going into hostile territory and turning the local population against the United States by their very presence, that the special forces are the people that are going to be used in the future. So is there anything in this budget that indicates that they're going to be boosting the special forces?
Yes. They didn't give numbers today, but they're certainly going to increase the budget. Their main constraint is, it takes a while to train somebody to do that kind of thing. So they're hoping to increase. They're at about 60,000 now, less than, around 5-10% of the total military. And they'd like to add, 2,000 or 3,000 people a year. So given all the places they seem to want to use them, and this, Panetta implied this in his little talk that, if we're not as involved in Afghanistan, it'll free up the special forces to operate in other parts of the world. So I think they're going to, put them on a pretty heavy schedule of training here, intervening there. Some openly, some secretive. And so I think that'll be, along with the drone strikes and so forth, the most heavily utilized part of the force.
So even if the tide of war is receding, that doesn't mean that the U.S. is not going to be more and more involved in these little covert wars, right?
Well, in terms of the numbers of wars, could certainly go up. It's just none of them will be involving hundreds of thousands of troops. And you know, some of the rhetoric sort of betrayed that. They talked about we can go anywhere, we can fight any adversary, we can win at any time, and how they're going to use innovative methods to be continue to be involved in Latin America and Africa, rotating troops, special forces. They didn't mention, but probably will include CIA operations, drone strikes, putting you know, temporary bases in places like, well, you know, Marines in Australia, naval forces in the Philippines and Singapore. So it's really, you know, they are in that sense trying to take advantage of the winding down of those two wars to be able to operate in more places.
Well, just in closing, William Hartung, you wrote Prophets of War, Prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, which really does give you a window into what really drives the defense budget and what is the most expensive, and the F-35 that we talked about is the most expensive weapon system in the history of man, and it is also one of the most troubled, and it's just mind-boggling to try and figure out why it is, if you have to cut the defense budget, why can't we cut something that is so manifestly a failure and a waste of money? And you'd think that the other people that need the money within the defense department, and we've been told for decades now that the fighting between the services in the Pentagon is almost as vicious as it is against any so-called enemy. You'd think that all the other services would be making the case that we need stuff for the 21st century threats, not worthless gold-plated turkeys for fighting the Cold War.
Well, I think quietly the Army's been saying that, and you know, certainly uniform members of the Army have that opinion, but of course they're not encouraged to express it. You know, I think if the administration really pushed down the top line of the budget, then you would see some of these inter-service rivalries. You'd see companies kind of competing rather than collaborating. You'd actually have almost like a divide-and-conquer strategy against the military-industrial complex. But if you're going to make such modest adjustments, everybody still feels they can get a, if not the, you know, the huge piece of pie that they were hoping for, a very substantial piece of pie out of the current plans.
So you think it's time for a teachable moment from the president, but I imagine the reason he's not doing it is that Lockheed Martin is one of the biggest lobbyists on Capitol Hill, right? And they probably have as many Democrats in their pockets as they do Republicans.
Very much so. You know, they have now about 1,000 lobbyists for the whole defense industry. Lockheed Martin has, you know, it's good 80, 100 or so. A lot of them worked in former Democratic administrations, for former Democratic members of Congress. Patty Murray, who co-chaired the super committee, had the largest number of former staffers going into lobbying for the industry. So, and she, of course, heads the Democratic Central Campaign Committee. So they are very much entrenched in both parties. And I think also, you know, just in terms of short-term political thinking, you know, I think Obama is, he doesn't want to pick a bigger fight than he's already going to have with the Buck McKeons of the world, who are so deep into the pockets of the arms industry that you can barely find them. So, you know, I think there is a short-term political calculation on his part, is that if he does something modest and he's criticized, you know, from the left as well as from the right, he can say, well, I guess I'm doing the right thing then, you know, kind of a not too big, not too small approach to policymaking.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who is the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets in the Religious Sense, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the making of the military-industrial complex. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich beating each other up to get the Latino vote in Florida.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Fooling on the human population. I know my mind's on the front line. Fearing, oh, I'm sure getting better. With every morn a new fear is born. But when I'm trusting,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Luis Martinez Fernandez, who is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luis Martinez Fernandez.
Thank you very much.
And as we speak, there is a debate on Univision between the Republicans, largely, of course, between Romney and Gingrich, trying to woo the Latino vote there in Florida. But it's a much more diverse vote, isn't it, than just the Cuban Americans. However, most of the Latinos probably vote Democrat, don't they?
That's true for the entire state, as for the rest of the nation. And there's a term that has been used a lot, and that is the Latino vote. A few years ago, I wrote a piece for the local newspaper as to whether there was such a thing as the Latino vote. And frankly, there's so many differences among the different groups, national groups that make up that vote, that it's very hard to speak of a Latino vote, especially here in Florida.
And so do the press have it wrong, saying that this is an important battleground in this race between Gingrich and Romney?
No. Still, the Cuban vote is very important for many reasons. But even when we look at the Cuban vote, that population, that electorate has been changing over the years. One characteristic that is very important to note is the high education levels, the high voting participation level among Cubans, and the fact that it is a population that, for obvious reasons, breathes politics on a daily basis because of their own particular history. Now, when you look at the number of Hispanic voters in Florida, you will, of course, find a large concentration of Cuban-American voters in South Florida. But if you look at the state as a whole, while Cuban-Americans and Cubans are 29% of the Hispanic population, Puerto Ricans are not far behind. They're 20% of that electorate. So that is something very interesting to keep in mind. And it's interesting that while the news have covered the Cuban-American or Cuban vote in Miami, there has been virtually no attention paid to the Hispanic vote in Central Florida, and that's for a good reason, and that is that most Puerto Ricans, which constitute the majority here, are not Republicans, so they will not be voting.
So already the most prominent Cuban-American politicians there, the three congresspeople in South Florida, are all for Romney. Romney's already apparently won most of the 200,000 absentee votes that were cast before Gingrich's surge. The LA Times has a front page story today where they quote Julian Perez, who's a 70-year-old immigrant from Cuba, who is rueing the fact that he already did his absentee vote for Romney along with his wife and brother, and now he's sorry that he voted for Romney because now he likes Gingrich. And we're talking about 368,000 registered Republicans in Miami-Dade County. Three quarters of them are Hispanic. So when you do the math, it looks like Romney's already, if he's got most of the 200,000 absentee ballots already in his favor, Gingrich has got quite a steep climb there to catch up, doesn't he?
He does, and I think that's one of the big problems with advanced voting, as we do here in Florida and it's done elsewhere, and that is that voters forfeit their opportunity to change their mind because they voted already. Now, as you mentioned, the three major Cuban-American leaders in Miami have endorsed Romney, who is at this point the establishment candidate. So it really doesn't surprise me that they have done that. However, I think it's very different within the Cuban American population, partially for cultural reasons. There was a formula in Cuban politics that in order to be elected, you had to have some sympathy in terms of being agreeable, a charming candidate, and politicians of the Romney style, who come across as being almost machine-like, who come across as being very, very pragmatic, don't do as well traditionally. Certainly not in Cuba, where the charismatic politician has been part of our history. But they don't do well in Florida as well, and that's something that, although there were many other factors playing, Bob Dole didn't do well. He would have done better. Then Al Gore didn't do well. There's something to be said about the charisma of the candidate. Of course, the substance is also very valuable. But when Gingrich said something along the lines of, "I believe in grandiose programs, I'm a romantic," these are things that he's been saying in Miami. Those are the kinds of things that are appealing to Cuban voters who traditionally, as part of our culture, have tended to favor the more charismatic leaders.
And, of course, Romney himself in 2008, when he ran against McCain, only earned 14% of the Latino vote in Florida. Again, I'm speaking with Luis Martinez Fernandez, a professor of history at the University of Central Florida, an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean, who grew up in Cuba and graduated from Puerto Rican University and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which is one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. And we're talking about this rather contentious battle for the Latino vote down in Florida, largely targeting the Cuban Americans. But Gingrich, I think, they're both trashing each other's records. But Gingrich has, I think, a little bit of an advantage, doesn't he, in terms of the anti-immigrant, even though maybe immigration is not a big issue with the Latino voters. They don't like being insulted as a race. And there's been an awful lot of that gratuitous insulting going on the Republican side. And, you know, Gingrich has made fun of Romney's idea of self-deportation. Yeah. But he also did take a more humane position on immigration, whereas Romney was pandering to the right wing of the Republican Party. And he also made, and by the way, the SEIU, which is a union that backs the Democratic Party largely, it's running an anti-Romney ad in Florida called Two Faces that criticizes Romney for allying himself with this rather unpleasant anti-immigration crusader, Chris Kobach, and promising to veto the Dream Act. So do you think that Romney's just he's just tacking too hard and fast to the right?
Well, that's part of the story. And actually, Romney has a history of making very serious mistakes when addressing the Cuban-American community. If there's one thing you don't want to do, if you wish not to offend the Cuban-American vote, is do not quote Fidel Castro. Back in 2007, and then actually Gingrich is reminding the voters about this, in one of his speeches he said, Patria o Muerte, which is fatherland or death, which is one of Fidel Castro's signature sayings. That was, of course, very bad advice that he received, and he said that he misquoted. That may have been, very well been the case, but what is important is the fact that Gingrich is reminding Cuban-American voters about that snafu. Now, it's interesting to talk about the position of the Cuban-American electorate in terms of immigration issues. As we know, Cuban-Americans have been favored historically by special considerations going back to 1964, the Cuban Adjustment Act, and even before that, that allow Cubans to come to this country, claim some sort of a political asylum based on persecution or potential persecution, and they have a very easy time coming into the country, and after a year, it's virtually automatic that they become residents. For the rest of Latin Americans, that's not the case, although for Puerto Ricans, it's even easier to come to the United States because they are American citizens, and it's like jumping on a plane from Cleveland to Detroit is the same as coming on a plane from Puerto Rico to, say, Miami. You don't have to show any documents. So there are two interesting forces that are here in opposition. On the one hand, because of the conservatism of the older Cuban voter, they have usually embraced a package of conservatism, which includes postures that are not favorable to immigration. However, and we have seen a dramatic change over the years, particularly when in 2008, Republicans embraced full-heartedly an anti-immigrant position, many Cubans became aware of how this was actually a racist position. So even though for them the issue of immigration is not as important as for Mexican Americans, they have begun to see that we cannot stand by this kind of position.
Well, that's what I was assuming, that it was a kind of collective insult. What do you make then, Luis Martinez Fernandez, of Romney's promise to reinstate the 2004 travel restrictions to Cuba that were lifted by the Obama administration? My understanding is, we could talk about how counterintuitive and counterproductive the 60-plus year-long embargo has been. It's basically kept the Castro brothers in power, I think, by most measures. The flights back and forth and the ability of Cuban Americans in Florida to help out their relatives in Cuba, I think it is quite popular. It may not be popular with the old diehard anti-Castro Cubans, but I think the younger generation understand the pragmatic necessity of keeping those ties open.
Yes, that's a very important question. If you look at the numbers of Cubans in this country, what Romney is doing is he's pandering to the most extremist element within the Cuban-American community. If you look at the changing face of the Cuban and Cuban-American population in Miami, we're talking about almost 400,000 Cubans that have come since 1998. We're also talking about a second and third generation of Cuban Americans who actually are against that kind of hard line. So he's pandering to that dwindling core of hardliners because it's still a favorable thing to do now, but this is something that is going to change. And by the way, the limiting of the travel to Cuba is something that is rejected by the population of the United States in general, which generally favors more opening and that it'd be easier for Cubans to send money back home.
Well, you have, because of the power of that Cuban-American lobby, you've got some ridiculous things like Radio Martí that's jammed every day, yet people show up and waste taxpayers' money making broadcasts that nobody sees. So there's a kind of absurdity to this sclerotic war that's been going on for over 60 years. I thank you for joining us here today, Luis Martinez Fernandez, and for filling us in on what's happening down in your state in terms of the Latino vote.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Luis Martinez Fernandez, who is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's largest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined in the studio by a former CIA officer who has written a brand new bestseller, The Interrogator, an Education.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count its ups. They lead you. Now they're taking and they're teaching and they're growing for life and they're setting on a path.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Glenn Carl, who is the author of the new book, The Interrogator, an Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And let me just touch on the latest story involving the CIA, and that's the arrest of John Kiriakou.
Kiriakou,
who I remember interviewing him when his book came out. And I don't know how he got into trouble. And one of the things I find extraordinary is how zealous the Obama administration has been in going after former CIA officials. This is the sixth government official charged with espionage by the Obama administration for leaking classified information to reporters.
It is a surprise, and I didn't know that there were six, but I and others have noted and felt that the Obama administration has been more vigorous or aggressive in this area than its predecessor, the Bush administration. Very surprising.
So I'm always puzzled, though, by why it is that the CIA is vilified in lots of quarters, particularly on the left in this country and around the world. And lots of things are attributed to them, which sometimes makes them sound even more skillful than they actually are, which I'm sure you'll agree with.
And no comment on that one.
But then, you know, when you think about Jack Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, mm-hmm. he said, I'm going to smash the CIA into thousands of pieces. But then he turned around and ended up using them with a vengeance to try and kill Castro. And maybe there was some blowback involved in that, and who knows. But the long and short of it was, he really used the CIA a lot. And then when Jimmy Carter, you know, he was elected at the time of the Church Commission, he came in vowing to rein in the CIA, and then he turned around once he became president, used them. And the point I'm getting at is that the CIA is essentially the favorite toy of the executive branch. And during the Cold War, where the president, in dealing with the Soviet Union, had only two unusable and useless options. One was thermonuclear war or sending a letter of protest, a diplomatic protest to the Soviet Union when they misbehaved. My understanding is that the CIA filled in the enormous range between the useless and the unusable. And I find it very ironic that presidents get away with stuff that gets blamed on the CIA.
Well, it is the nature of the beast, really. It's an easy whipping boy because a politician will have to adopt and may sincerely believe the moral positions or postures that he takes in a campaign or in a speech. And one hopes that public life will be conducted according to the golden rule and so on. But in fact, of course, that's not the case and never has been in international relations. It's a matter of power, interests, and defending and advancing them. So intelligence work and intelligence agency is a critical component of any competent or functioning government, has always been and always will be, because there have to be options between doing nothing and destroying yourself entirely. And if there is a possibility sometimes of acting in a way that doesn't create a public problem and yet it does advance one's interests, then one will pursue it. So it's not a surprise that the CIA is always a central part of an administration's toolbox.
So we started out the program talking about Defense Secretary Panetta's press conference today, talking about budget cuts that aren't really budget cuts. And we also talked about how this new strategic national security landscape has so radically changed since the Cold War, where instead of national threats, it's unlikely that nation states will ever go to war anymore, which is our entire history is about nation states and alliances of nation states going to war. That has suddenly changed. That's gone away. And then these subnational and transnational threats have emerged. And we've had all of these wars, which even though the military is basically still buying Cold War weaponry, the only people that are actually being used nowadays are special forces, more and more, and they will be more and more in the future. And they are very closely allied with the CIA, although there is this thing called Joint Special Operations Command. Mm-hmm. So give us a sense of what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the militarization of the CIA and the fact that they now the head of the CIA is this general who right. comes out of he didn't come out of special forces, but he certainly has been using special forces.
Well, over half the directors of the CIA in the history of the CIA have been from the military. It's always a phenomenon that – or a fact that has disturbed, I would say, most career civilian CIA officers who would prefer a civilian head either coming from within the ranks or from outside rather than the military. But that's a separate issue. The rise and fall, or the ebb and flow is probably better to say, of the paramilitary focus and resources of the CIA and its cooperation and work with the special forces of the uniformed services has always occurred. When I started my career, it was one of the heydays of the Special Activities Division, the paramilitary forces. That was in the early mid-80s because we were fighting the Sandinistas through our surrogates, the Contras, and also trying to defeat the Soviets through our surrogates, the Mujahideen. When those two wars petered out or ended for one reason or another, then it was no longer – and the Cold War ended, then paramilitary forces in the Special Activities Division were no longer the darlings of policy and the CIA, and they dwindled dramatically. After 9/11 and since, it has once again flowed rather than ebbed, and that has been the center of our activities and what seems to be the in thing to do. But it's driven by policy and it goes up and down that way. While the core of the CIA work always remains human intelligence collection.
Well, let's just touch on blowback because you brought up Afghanistan and the Soviet war and training the Mujahideen who Bin Laden was a part of that. And that's certainly come back to haunt us. I think didn't the Dulles brothers start out – their notion of defeating Arab socialism was to encourage Islamic radicalism. Is there a history there that we used the green to fight the red and now the greens come back to bite us?
Well, it's no one can predict the future very well. We can be sure that there will be unintended and often unwanted consequences to whatever covert action that we take. That's not an argument, in my mind, to not engage in covert actions at certain times, but it's a very delicate thing to do which administrations tend to presidential administrations tend to like probably more than career intelligence officers do, because we're more aware of the bad things that are likely to occur.
You're aware of the third law of thermodynamics, right? That for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
So, that's right.
Again, I am joined in the studio by Glenn Carl, who's the author of the new book, The Interrogator and Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. And he's the author, of course, of The Interrogator and Education. Tell me about, the book itself is talks about this incredible struggle that you went on because you were involved in these CIA black sites and interrogating these al-Qaeda prisoners. And you knew pretty much from the outset that one of the guys that they thought was an incredibly high-value target, they had the wrong guy. And the more that you protested the kind of stupidity of what was going on, the more they adopted so-called enhanced interrogation methods on this poor guy. And that caused your conscience to have serious problems with your oath to the Constitution to protect and defend it.
It did. It was actually Kafkaesque, and I thought that I had entered a world of where the laws of nature didn't really obtain in the normal way, because I literally had the following exchange with headquarters repeatedly. I would send in a report saying, I believe that he has answered truthfully and he does not know the answer to questions X and Y. And the response was, the fact that he is not answering is proof that he is withholding information. Therefore, you are instructed to pressure him more. And I thought that was just unbelievable, because it doesn't follow sensibly at all. And I would go through the same argument again, and the order would come back. And I concluded that I was dealing, I really did. I thought, well, the officer who's responding to me is a fool. But I was wrong. It turned out, and I didn't know this for years, that he was following his orders. And the formal doctrine of the Directorate of Operations in interrogations at that period of time for several years was, the absence of an answer is proof of withholding information calling for enhanced pressure, which was insane.
So was this CIA doctrine being influenced by Dick Cheney, being pushed by it, or did this precede him?
Well,
because my understanding
right.
is that, you know, from people like Larry Wilkerson, who was, Colin Powell's chief of staff,
sure.
who was first to blow the whistle on what he called the Cheney Rumsfeld cabal, who enabled torture. The what you hear from Larry and others is that this is was all driven by Cheney.
I do not know firsthand if that's the case. That is certainly how I assess the dynamic to work. We, the CIA, the Directorate of Operations and the offices within that directorate conducting interrogations, where I was working for a time, were clearly responding to the guidance and instructions and parameters set by the administration. There's no question about that. So Colonel Wilkerson's assessment is mine also.
So, and of course, Colonel Wilkerson sat outside on the seventh floor for almost 2 days with the head of the CIA selling Colin Powell the bogus intelligence on the Iraq war. And Powell kept saying, this is crap, this is crap. And Tenet kept saying, well, this is the best we have. And right. yet in-house, Tyler Drumheller had told Tenet that Curveball, the main source of the information, who came from Chalabi's neocon shop, was full of it.
Well, the
and was a nutcase, in effect.
Yeah, the agency had always been pretty clear inside, and I believe in our assessments to policymakers, that Chalabi was not someone to be trusted at all. And the way he was became a phoenix-like figure was he had been rejected and rebuffed and turned away as someone not trustworthy by the CIA and the intelligence services, and then was picked up as the darling by neocon politicians. And politicians may speak with whomever they wish, and that's how the end run occurred that way. But the agency always knew that his information was self-interested and designed to influence, not inform, which is unacceptable for an intelligence officer.
Right, but why did Tenet set pile up because of power.
Well, I don't think Tenet did intentionally, actually. And it's, yeah. It is a mystery to me because I know Tenet some, and I know Tyler Drumheller pretty well, and I consider them both men of integrity, and their stories are diametrically opposed. I also know, I did not work directly on, at that time, Curveball at all, but I know that the hallway view within the directorate of operations of Curveball was that he was not to be untrustworthy, unreliable. The dynamic occurred. I think this is important to know. What happened, and Tenet, I think, acted in good faith. What happened was the director of operations of the CIA said, Curveball is not to be trusted. We have doubts about this guy. But the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, said, our assessment is that he is good. And there was a clash, and there was a... It went up for adjudication, essentially, to the top of the CIA's command. And I think it was John McLaughlin, the Tenet's deputy, who said he had to decide somehow, do we use this or not? And I believe his decision was, this is a military-related reporter, informer, and the DIA is the military intelligence branch, and I will side with them and their supposed expertise rather than the director of operations, which is not. And Tenet then went with that decision, I think in good faith, and it was all wrong. And the DIA didn't really know what it was talking about.
Well, the DIA, though, and the Defense Department itself was pretty influenced by the neocons.
Absolutely. Oh, of course. Yeah. There's no question. But I think, yes, the answer to that is yes. Right. And they gamed the system, as right. happened over and over again. And now, in that specific instance of Curveball, I was not firsthand involved. But I was involved in any number of instances when the dynamic that you touch upon played out. Right. And that's how the information was queered, frankly.
Right. Well, I looked into the forgery of the Niger papers because, you know, the whole Joe Wilson,
sure.
Valerie Plame story.
Well.
And nobody tracked that one. I mean, the amazing thing is, and nobody actually looked into the forgery. They all talked about Wilson's, you know, fool's errand to Niger. You know, some of the top senior guys, Vince Canestrero, told me that they were forged, not by
right.
the Italians, but actually by the neocons. So,
I don't know if they were forged by the neocons, but they were certainly forged by someone who was seeking to influence American policy. I don't know what our assessment right. on who forged them was. But
nobody really looked into it sufficiently. And what was interesting was that Dick Cheney kept trying to sell these forged documents to the CIA.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there were so many different bits of information that one puts together to make a mosaic and then an assessment. The focus has been on Joe Wilson because of his article. And I've known Joe for 3 decades, and he's a man of integrity who told exactly the truth. I mean, that's just a fact. But it's also true, his was one bit of information. He was not a central player in the whole dynamic. What he reported corresponded and confirmed almost an infinite number of other disparate bits of information, all of which pretty strongly added up to there's no smoking gun and there's no yellow cake to be alarmed about here. The forgery, what it was, should not have been that fundamental an issue given the overarching effort made by the intelligence community that reached a clear conclusion, all of which was not congenial to the policymakers and so therefore was undermined and or ignored.
But the bottom line still remains, Glenn Carl, that we went to war on false, forged, and fraudulent information.
I would add one other thing, and sincerely obtained wrong assessments.
So, and just to finish up on Chalabi, Chalabi dropped a dime on this country, on the CIA, and on the national security apparatus by telling his Iranians, who he's always close to, he told the Iranians that the National Security Agency had broken their top secret code. I mean, it's extraordinary.
I'm not familiar with that, actually, and I don't know how Chalabi would have been aware of that if it were true.
He was told. Okay, I'll give you the source on it.
There's
a very, very good book written about it.
Yeah.
This came out.
We always thought Chalabi was
Arrows in the Night, and it really goes into quite considerable detail about.
We always viewed him as bad news to be avoided.
Right. But, well, Glenn Carr, again, the author of the new book, The Interrogator in Education. Glenn was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Your story is, of course, an uncomfortable story for both your personal story and for the agency itself. What's going on though? Do they want to put it behind them? Or they're not being particularly. They're not happy about what you're doing, right? It doesn't sound like
the intelligence community,
yeah.
The CIA. Yeah, well, I think that's a fair statement. Sure, it's. Right. Well, I write about a series of errors. I mean, I made as many errors as anyone in my career, of course. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. There's no dishonor in that. It's also a very delicate political and legal issue, and that makes people very nervous. And that we, the intelligence community, the CIA, found ourselves in a position where we were explicitly following legal guidance and parameters that we demanded, that yet clearly undermined our system of laws, is an awkward position to be in. And my colleagues and I, from the outset, many of us were acutely ill at ease about the circumstances that we were being led into.
But the long and the short of it is it's all sort of been brushed under the rug. The president, who to some extent ran on the outrage of what was felt that the Bush administration was overstepping its executive authority. What an irony that the National Defense Authorization Act gives President Obama more authority in regard to military detaining even American citizens and even disappearing them, all resting on the good faith of the President of the United States. You find that ironic? That Bush and Cheney would never have gotten, they didn't even ask for those privileges.
Right. I wouldn't use the term ironic, although I am ironic by nature. It's really disturbing to me that our fears continue to convince people that policymakers that we need to take measures that undermine the principles that we believe we are trying to uphold. I don't think the measures are necessary. They never are necessary, really, and they are counterproductive. I am surprised and disappointed.
Well, you have to be reminded, I think, of Ben Franklin's adage that he who would choose temporary security over liberty deserves neither.
That's a quote of Franklin's I'm not familiar with, but once again, he's a wise man.
We'll fact check it later, but I think it's pretty accurate.
It is. It's one of the fundamental principles of our judicial system and legal system in our society is to err on the side of protecting the rights of the accused and accepting sometimes the ill effects that can engender or cause, because not all accused are innocents. Mm-hmm. But it's a better principle than to err in the other direction where innocent people might suffer.
Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you, Glenn Carr, again for joining us, the author of the new book, The Interrogator in Education. Glenn Carr was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years, retired in March of 2007 as a Deputy National National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and production assistant Kelly Hargraves. You can sign up for podcasts at ianmasters.com and contact me there. I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was